Our first reading this morning is from Karen Armstrong's book, The Great Transformation, in which she highlights the similarities of developing thought around the world between the years 900 and 200 before the Common Era. Taking a nod from German philosopher Karl Jaspers, she calls that period of human development the Axial Age.
If the Buddha or Confucius had been asked whether he believed in God, he would probably have winced slightly and explained, with great courtesy, that this was not an appropriate question. If anybody had asked Amos or Ezekiel if he was a monotheist who believed in only one God, he would have been equally perplexed. What mattered was not what you believed, but how you behaved. Religion was about doing things that changed you at a profound level. Before the Axial Age, ritual and animal sacrifice had been central to the religious quest. You experienced the divine in sacred dramas that, like a great theatrical experience today, introduced you to another level of experience. The Axial Sages changed this. They still valued ritual, but gave it new ethical experience and put morality at the heart of the spiritual life. Today, we often assume that before undertaking a religious lifestyle, we must prove to our own satisfaction that God or the Absolute exists. This is good scientific practice. First, you establish a principle. Only then you apply it. But the Axial sages of old, would say that this was to put the cart before the horse. First, you must commit yourself to an ethical life, then disciplined and habitual benevolence, not metaphysical conviction, would give you intimations of the transcendence you sought. This meant you had to be ready to change.
Our second reading today, William Stafford's poem, The Way It Is, was written just a few short weeks before his death of a heart attack at age 79.
There's a thread you follow. It goes among things that change, but it doesn't change. People wonder about what you are pursuing. You have to explain about the thread, but it is hard for others to see. While you hold it, you can't get lost. Tragedies happen. People get hurt or die. And you suffer and get old. Nothing you can do can stop time's unfolding. But you don't ever let go of the thread.
Following a beautiful piece of music and a sublime poem, you never let go of the thread. We'll see if I'll add a little confusion or maybe highlight things just a bit this morning. This summer, a month ago now, but it feels like yesterday, I worked a long week with my brother clearing out our mother's things from her old house. We had a deadline, we worked hard, and we made the deadline. If you would have asked my mother in her last few years of her life what she wished most she would have been able to do before she died, she would have told you to clean out the attic. Now, if that sounds a little off to you, maybe aiming a little low in life's values, let me give you a bit of perspective. In the summer of 1979, the family moved from a town where folks were teachers and carpenters to a town where folks were doctors and lawyers. So we could only afford a much smaller house than the one we previously had. The house was so much smaller that while my brother and I each had our own room, bedroom, our closets were filled with things overflow. Things that didn't fit in the rest of the house, didn't fit in the attic, were stored in our closets. Such was my parents' need for extra space that they left two full boxes of what my father affectionately liked to call hooch in my closet. Two full cases of hard liquor. I was going on 15. This was not my parents' smartest move. Never did talk to either of them about that. I say all this to point out that my brother and I, Glenn and I, spent 2.5 days cleaning everything out of an absolutely full attic. From the summer of 79 when we moved in, we filled it then. We added to it. Nothing ever came down. There were things we found this summer that had not been touched in, what was that, 31 years, something like that? When we were done, the only thing left was one old wooden chest of drawers with the drawers out and emptied. The chest was stuffed underneath the rafters, and we realized that we had no idea how it got up there. It was too big for the little stairway that came down on a hinge, you know, that kind that you pull down from the attic. And so we were either going to have to buy more power tools and cut it apart or leave it there for prosperity. We rationalized that it was holding up the roof, and so we left it where it was. The rest of the week, we spent going all the things we had pulled down from the attic, deciding what to do with each, who would get what, and what would go into a huge dumpster we had in the driveway, which we filled to our delight. It was a week of love and sorrow, of dinners with aunts, uncles, cousins, and at every meal, heaping portions of nostalgia. I miss a great deal about my mother. Today, though, I want to talk about one aspect of her life that I don't miss. It's something I have a personal regret about, but it also tinges into where we are in the life of our religious movement. What you have to know about my mother is that from the day she became a Unitarian, she was active in her church. From weeding during work parties to chairing the caring committee for years, for running covenant groups, plural, some at the same time, and serving as vice president of the church board, she never rested long when it came to church work or any work for that matter. Over the years, Mom and I would talk often on the phone, sometimes only a couple times a month, usually a couple times a week, and in almost every conversation, she'd offer another installment of what I like to call, "Eric, why is our new minister here Christian?" Even though her minister had been there at the end, coming up on 20 years, and my father had been chair of the search committee that called him to the church, she was never able to shake her notion that at some level, the faith of the minister being different from her own was putting her at risk of losing her church. She had come into Unitarianism at a time and place that was a mecca for skeptics, for freethinkers and atheists. And that's the faith she knew. And that was the faith that she chose. And while she called herself a mystical humanist, a lovely term I can only think I understand, her minister's use of religious language unsettled her to the core, or she wouldn't have brought it up as often as she did. I know that there were times that she spoke directly with him, and exactly what was said or heard during those conversations, I don't know. That's not my business. What I do know was that her concerns, her fear of losing her church, was never fully eased. And if this was something I had only experienced with her, I wouldn't be talking about it with you this morning. I've also had countless conversations with members here at this church and in other churches I've served, people who have come to me and said, "Eric, I'm really tired of feeling like a closeted Christian here. I wish I could talk about my faith life, my prayer life. I could talk about the model that Jesus provides me and informs my Unitarian Universalist faith." Now, I have to say I've experienced less of this here, but I still have experienced this here. Otherwise, I wouldn't be mentioning this morning. The first congregation I solved, listen to me, right. The first congregation I was called to loved to tell the story. They bought their building they were still in from a Baptist congregation. They loved to tell the story of taking down the cross in the middle of the night. The church came with the cross, paid for it, it's up there. Didn't quite fit their approach, so they knew they needed to be careful about this. They went to the senior liberal Presbyterian clergyman in town who said, "I see what you mean, but you know, if people see you doing this, they're never going to forgive or forget." So in the middle of the night, a crew of able-bodied humanist Unitarians climbed up on the roof and began dismantling the cross. Just about sunrise, they were finished, and there was light enough for one photograph of the bearded board chair carrying the cross across the roof. The irony was missed on no one, and they loved it. It's been years since I've been wanting to tell that story from a pulpit. Well, this was a decision based on theological preference. I've also heard congregants, not here, thankfully, assert that we Unitarian Universalists were never a Christian or Christian denominations. This was someone who hadn't done much fact-checking. The precursor to our denomination's magazine, the UU World, was the Christian Register. And if you want proof that not only our theology has changed over the years, but that we haven't always been the liberal folk we think we are, go to one of our libraries in Berkeley or Cambridge and look at issues of the Christian Register for the 1840s. And there you will find in nearly every issue, on almost every page in some issues, articles and letters to the editor, both in support of the abolitionist cause and arguing with rhetorical skill, every rhetorical skill at the tool at their disposal, that slavery is good for our nation and justified under God. We've changed since then, but we cannot pretend that we haven't been in conflict. We can't pretend that we were always on the side of an issue we claim to be on now. Well, there have been Unitarian catechisms here and there throughout history. The influence of Transylvanian pastor and court, what's the word I'm looking for? Supporter, advisor, has long cast a long shadow on our tradition. We resist creedal tests. Francis David was the one who said, we do not think alike, need to think alike, to love alike. We like to keep our options open. We don't like feeling pinned down. We believe, using more traditional religious language now, that revelation is not sealed. And we are bringing new truths, new interpretations, new understandings to ourselves and to the wider world all the time. Speaking generally, we believe that human understanding evolves and changes tenor based on the interests and needs of the day and age. We talk about our love for community now, in a time when families live closer together and people didn't move as much for work. We didn't talk about community in anywhere near the same kind of reverence. The word didn't have the resonance as it does to us today. We have had changes. As I mentioned, our magazine used to be called the Christian Register. Without going into a full-bore history lesson here, let me say that when Emerson and other transcendentalists of the day came on the scene, they were not looked at kindly by the folks who were in charge. They were the Young Turks. As they got older, their views disseminated and became much more the norm, but it didn't have to be that way. It was that way because there was some thread that we were able to hold on to. Their sense of direct experience of wonder that we resonated with then and now. So we have to hold on to what we know is true, and we have to be able to be open to ideas that are new and challenging. It'd be easy for me to say, and it's too pat, that in all the things Mom had cluttered in her attic, there wasn't room for something new. Well, that may or may not be far too pat. I remember when I was in school, and several teachers would talk about the pendulum of human history. We'd have an arc this way, and then there'd be a backlash, and we'd go over there. And we'd go from one pole to another. And I wonder if that thinking wasn't in some of my mother's concern. She felt that if the denomination was becoming more Christian, more used to what she saw as backward, not necessarily traditional religious language, that we were moving backward in time. I've talked to a lot of Unitarian Universalist Christians, and I don't see anything that makes me feel like we're going back to the days of old unquestioned dogma. I think about that pendulum idea from one side to the other, and I think, you know, something's missing there. That model, that pendulum, that metaphor is just too small. And when I think about it a little bit, you know, a small pendulum just goes back and forth. But if you have a big pendulum, what happens? Who remembers what Foucault did? Yes! To prove that the earth rotates, he set a big pendulum right from the very top, a big brass knob weighing about 50 pounds, and he let it go on one side. And you know what? It went off at an angle. And I can't exactly describe the physics. These guys can. Mark, I'm sure, could. Never quite got it in my head. But it goes off at an angle. And depending on how far north or south of the equator you are, it will either make a circle rather quickly in a day or in a little longer. In fact, if I have it right, if it was not for wind resistance, that brass knob would never pass under the spot that it was hung from. It always goes around. Now, I love that metaphor. That reminds me of all those notions from Jewish tradition that we can never name God. How many names we have, it's never going to describe the full. And from the Tao Te Ching, the myriad ways will never describe the true way. We are like that brass knob, making a circle, but never coming exactly to the center. Our understanding will never be perfect. Our expression will never be able to describe the awe and wonder and rule that moves us as an arc through time, through our lives. Our interpretations are always imperfect. Our expressions are always less than we would wish them to be. I wish I would have had that metaphor for my mom, but it came to me more recently. So I share it with you today. Let there be room in our hearts. Let there be room in our community. Let there be room between you and I, room between one another, for questions and answers, for straight talking, and really grappling to understand where we come from and where we want to go, the gifts we have to share, and what we can learn from one another. We're never moving backward if we can help it. Thank you. Thank you.